Lesson 12. More scientific claims? Thank you for listening to Lesson 12 of Loving the Homosexual to Healing with Truth. Today's lesson covers three contributing factors. Listen as we seek to deal with this puzzle.
You will take your Bible and look in 1 Corinthians chapter 6. And again, we have looked at this passage in detail, but it relates to our final items that we're studying in this series. And I am tonight going to look at the rest of the claims versus evidence concerning homosexuality, and then the causes or the contributing factors to homosexuality. And then next week we'll finish with what are we to do? How do we engage and approach and reach people who have who are a part of the homosexual lifestyle? But this passage is really germane in relationship to what we're studying about the contributing factors, but also these claims versus evidence. And in verse 9, the Spirit of God said, of chapter 6, says, "Or do you not know, you Corinthians, don't you know, that the unrighteous shall not inherit the kingdom of God? Do not be deceived, or stop being deceived. Neither fornicators, nor idolaters, nor adulterers, nor effeminate," and that's the feminine role of the homosexual relationship, "nor homosexuals," the male role, "nor thieves, nor the covetous, nor drunkards, nor revilers, nor swindlers shall inherit the kingdom of God. And such were some of you, but you were washed, you were sanctified, you were justified in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ and in the Spirit of God." And that passage really tells us about three things related to what we're looking at. Number one, it tells us this is not natural. It's no more natural than being a fornicator or being a reviler or a swindler or an idolater or an adulterer. It's not normal. It's not natural. The second thing is that God didn't create them this way. Now, not all of them claim that, but those that want to be involved in Christianity and go to Christian churches and be accepted, they do. And it's very clear that God calls it unrighteous. So it is not something that God created. And the third thing that I would say is that notice that there is the potential for change, because some of these had changed. So the Bible is very clear on these three things. It's not natural, not normal. It is not because God created them that way. And it is not immutable, meaning that they are not consigned to that. They can change. So what I want to do tonight is review the one claim we've looked at versus the evidence, and then look at the others that are made by the homosexual researchers and supporters. The number one claim that we looked at and we answered, it is that homosexuality has been repeatedly demonstrated to be and is in fact an innate genetically determined condition. And that's really probably the most prominent claim about homosexuality, but we found that that in fact is not true. Actually, the researchers have found the very opposite of that. And the only researchers that I refer to are those who were actually homosexuals or they were affirmative of the homosexual lifestyle, and they wanted the evidence to show that, but the evidence did not demonstrate that, not one time. Also, there are studies that say, well, there's a difference in the way they smell, a homosexual and a heterosexual, meaning smelling perfumes and so forth like that. But again, it doesn't tell us whether those differences are a part of what precipitates homosexuality or heterosexuality, or are the consequence of that. Remember, just because they find something, it doesn't tell you whether or not that is because of the behavior or the cause of the behavior, if you will. It may be, in fact, the result of the behavior. Another thing we saw, that man is more than the sum of his physical parts, and there's really no one gene that causes anything like that. We are more than that. There's not one gene determining our destiny in a certain area, whether it's physical or psychological, spiritual, and so forth. And by the way, as a believer, even if they find that there's something genetic, I mean, there should be, if our faith is right, because we believe that the fall was total and that there is total depravity, and it affected us physically and psychologically and spiritually and relationally, cognitively, emotionally, etc., in every area. So I should expect that there are these problems, like dying is one we might mention. Genetic predispositions, if they find a gene and they say that gene, all these people who do this have this gene, a genetic predisposition doesn't in and of itself tell you that that's the right thing. For example, you may have a genetic predisposition to heart disease or cancer or early senility, but that doesn't tell us it's good or right. Matter of fact, we find these genetic predispositions, and what are we trying to do? We're trying to fight against them. So just because it's a genetic predisposition doesn't mean, ipso facto, that it is in fact a good genetic predisposition. I mean, sociopathological people have some messed up physiology and wiring and so forth, but we don't accept that just good. We don't say, well, you know, they've got this gene, and so just let them, you know, do what they do, because it must be good. So even that argument doesn't stand up. Nothing really stands up under scrutiny of that claim, and yet it would not surprise me you wouldn't hear it or read it in the course of this week in some book or magazine or television show. So we've looked at that. The second claim is that homosexuality is an immutable state of an individual, meaning that it can't be changed. If you are a homosexual, there is nothing that can change that. You are that, and any kind of therapy that tries to get you to change, like 1 Corinthians, is really harmful, they would say. Dr. Settenover says, a review of all of the research over many years demonstrates a consistent 30% to 52% success rate in the treatment of unwanted homosexual attraction. If they want it, there's nothing in the world you can do with it. And if you want to put those statistics in proportion or in perspective, let's say it's 50% that there's a success rate. You don't have that kind of success rate sharing the gospel of Christ. And it's the power of God unto salvation. Those are incredible. He goes on to say, Masters and Johnson has reported a 65% success rate after a five-year follow-up. Other professionals report success rates ranging from 30% to 70%. So it's just not true that there aren't success rates in this. Dr. Lisa Diamond, professor at University of Utah, concludes, quote, sexual identity is far from fixed in women who aren't exclusively heterosexual, end quote. Dr. Robert Spitzer, and he is a prominent psychiatrist, he's a researcher at Columbia University, and he has been the chief architect of the American Psychiatric Association's Diagnostic Manual, which I told you is their Bible. He was the chief decision maker in the 1973 decision that removed homosexuality from the Diagnostic Manual as an abnormality. He considers himself openly gay affirmative. He is a longtime supporter of gay rights. And he has been long time convinced that homosexuality is neither a disorder or changeable. But the discussion within the psychological community about this potential for changing their orientation caused him to at least say, I'm going to do my own research in this area and see what I find. Here's what he said, and I quote, I'm convinced from the people I've interviewed that for many of them, they have made substantial changes towards becoming heterosexual. I think that's news. I came to this study skeptical. I now claim that these changes can be sustained, end quote. This is the chief architect of getting it removed from their Bible. And now he says they can be. Well, after he did his own research and his studies, he began skeptical, by no way biased towards the conclusion that he came to. He went back and he approached and he presented his results to the gay and lesbian committees of the APA. And what he anticipated, he said, was I anticipated when I showed them my research that there would be a scientific debate. But he was surprised. He was shocked. And he said, I was shocked because of the intense pressure that was put upon me to withhold my findings for political reasons. Dr. Spitzer has subsequently received a considerable amount of hate mail. Douglas C. Aldman, he's a PhD and independent practitioner in Seattle, Washington. He is a prominent gay affirmative theorist. So all the people I'm quoting are people who like it. Either they are or aren't, except Dr. Santover. He says this, quote, from the perspective of gay theorists and activists, the question of conversion therapy's efficacy or lack thereof is irrelevant. Now put that in Rogerian terminology. They don't give a hoot if all of the research says that you can change. So they're not looking at the facts. He goes on to say, it has been seen as a social phenomenon, one that is driven by anti-gay prejudice in society, end quote. So what he's saying is they don't care about the research. They don't care. They have it in their mind. It is you are homophobic. And that's the drum they're going to beat no matter what the evidence says. Camille Paglia, I suppose is the way you pronounce her name. She is a lesbian activist. And this is what she says, quote, is the gay identity so fragile that it cannot bear the thought that some people may not wish to be gay? Sexuality is highly fluid and reversals are theoretically possible. However, habit is a refractory, meaning hard to change once you develop a habit, and once the sensory pathways have been blazed and deepened by repetition. And they find this with obesity or smoking or drinking. In other words, when you take on a behavior and you set up these pathways of your brain, it is very hard to change that. Goes on to say, helping gays to learn how to function heterosexually if they wish is a perfectly worthy aim, end quote. And she's a lesbian activist. She goes on to say, locking into a choice versus genetic dichotomy obscures reality. Unchangeable versus therapeutic, same. And then she says this, the research is well documented that, and I quote, the majority of homosexuals become heterosexual spontaneously without therapy. Now what that means is that they're going along and they're either involved in a homosexual relationship or they have those desires or they're doing something, and they just, the vast majority who end up being heterosexual, they just stop without therapy or anything. She says this, I bet this lit their fire. She says, and I quote, we should be honest enough to consider whether homosexuality may not indeed be a pausing at the prepubescent stage where children anxiously band together by gender, end quote. What she's saying is, maybe it is not genetic, maybe you're not created that way, maybe it is you're hung up in this phase and you never moved out of it, and there is a lot to be said for that. So that claim is false. It's false by their own admission, by the studies, by the longitudinal studies, by the testimony of Scripture. It is simply false. Third, they claim that the only disadvantages of homosexuality are those caused by social disapproval and discrimination. In other words, being homosexual, there are no negatives to that except what people like you and I put upon them. What society, the discrimination, all of these things, we're the ones that cause the problems, not them. Well, Bailey, who was a part of the twin study that we looked at, he examined this question whether homosexuality is associated with a higher level of psychopathology. And here's what he said. Homosexuality represents a deviation from normal development and is associated with other such deviations that may lead to mental illness. He goes on to another possibility, that increased psychopathology among homosexual people is a consequence of lifestyle differences associated with sexual orientation. That's apart from whether we like it or not, or affirm it or not. That is something that goes along with it, that there's this greater amount of psychopathology. He cited some things specifically, but one of them is the risks that are inherent with male homosexuality that are not inherent in male heterosexuality. And then he says, it would be a shame if socio-political concerns prevent researchers from conscientious consideration of any reasonable hypothesis. Meaning that the pressures are such that if a researcher comes out with a hypothesis that maybe could explain the phenomenon that doesn't fit their political agenda, they ought to be able to bring it out without being attacked and maligned and so forth. There are innumerable studies that have been done in different centers around the U.S. and other countries that tell us about some risk. For example, a 20-year-old man who identifies himself as gay carries a 30% greater risk of being HIV positive or dead from AIDS by the age of 30. That is inherent to that lifestyle. In Canada, they did a study and they published it, and the gay male identification is associated with a life expectancy that's comparable to the life expectancy in Canada in 1870. And this was just published. So there are clearly, apart from whether we like it or not, there are these psychopathologies, there's physical issues, and so forth. Claim number four. A society composed of same-sex couples raising children and family-like units will differ from a society composed of traditional family units in no undesirable ways. So, to put it another way, is that same-sex households will have no ill effects upon children and age, and upon society. And one researcher that is often quoted in this, who supposedly did research to prove this, she also gave testimony in a court hearing, and the judge excoriated her for not giving the evidence of her research to prove what she was saying. And even her own counsel, whom she was speaking for, was the ACLU, said, give them the research so they can evaluate it, and she wouldn't do it. So we don't know what she was looking at. Here's what Satinover says. What is known from decades of research on family structure, studying literally thousands of children, is that every departure from the traditional, stable, mother-father family has severe detrimental effects upon children. And these effects persist not only into adulthood, but into the next generation as well. What they are insidiously instituting is not only homosexuality, but they are instituting a concept that a child only needs one parent. And it doesn't matter which one it is, the male or the female. In other words, what they're saying by this whole argument is that someone is superfluous. Either the mom or the dad. Two homosexuals, being male or female, can raise this child the same and no ill effects, which there's no evidence to that. And we're going to see the consequences of this as the years go by. And it's going to be absolutely devastating. Well, so that's some of the claims that really have no verification and no real evidence. And by the way, you can study just basically anywhere you want. You will find that children that grow up either in divorced homes, single homes, homosexuals, somewhere where there's not this, what we would call the biblical family, they do worse in school statistically. They are more involved in crime. They have more psychological problems. They're less emotional skills. They have less social skills. And on and on and on it goes. I mean, the list is overwhelming. And these can be found in all kinds of research. Well, let me talk a little bit about some of the root causes. And what I'm drawing from is there is a organization called People Can Change. And a homosexual organization, and they promote the change, but they're also made up of people who wanted to change and have changed to varying degrees and so forth. And in 2004, they surveyed their members and they asked, what did the members think were contributing factors to their homosexuality? Now, they gave 25 possible factors. So if you were one in there and you were looking at it, there was a list of 25 and you could pick them and then you would rate them and so forth and so on. And this kind of study is somewhat akin to, it would be different than going out to the homosexual community at large, who many of them want to be where they are, at least ostensibly they do. And so they're trying to prove that it's okay. But this group has made the change or wants to change. And it would be like the difference in a study when they study what people out here that are lost and are living ungodly lives and they say the church ought to be. It's quite different, the results you get, than when they study them who have come into the church or salvation recently within a year, what drew them and what they desire. It's a very different thing. So this is the group that they're dealing with, and 200 homosexuals responded. So, and by the way, if you've been in men's fraternity, I mean, some of this is just, it's like we're reading out of men's fraternity about how important it is for the relationships with father and mother and so forth. But listen to what it says. The first thing is the father-son relationship problems. 97% said that this contributed to their developing same-sex attraction. And they usually identified it as one of the three most significant contributors. Is that there was a problem between the dad, the father, and the son. They say, it seems very rare for a man who struggles with homosexuality to feel that he was sufficiently loved, affirmed, and mentored by his father growing up, or that he identified with his father as a male role model. Oftentimes, the father-son relationship is marked by, and this could be actual or perceived on the son's side, abandonment, extended absence, hostility or disinterest. Perceived abandonment, extended absence, hostility or disinterest. When they asked them, 97% said that there was a problem in this relationship, and that was listed as one of the top three contributors out of these 25. They say, whatever the source of the estrangement, it is the common experience for many of us to have felt a deep longing to be held and to be loved by a father figure. Now, if that doesn't tug on your heart as a believer, this is why we can't be cool and we can't be condescending and we can't treat it as some kind of light choice. I'm not saying there's not choice. I'm saying it's not like drinking a 7-Up or a Diet Coke. There's more involved. There's enormous hurt and loss in the development or the lack of development. It says they want to be loved by a father figure, to be mentored in the world of men, and to have our masculine natures affirmed by other men. And that's the thing that we find in men's fraternity. Men need men. So this issue about this father-son relationship or lack thereof. Now, this is incredible stuff for you who have young families to think through what you're doing. And the dad cannot be passive. He has to be actively engaged in both the daughter and the son, but particularly the son. Second, they noted a conflict with male peers. And this is the same percentage, 97%. And they said that the problems in male peer relationships contributed. One of the things they say is, somehow, even as boys or young teenagers, we felt like we were never man enough. We felt like we didn't live up to the masculine idea. We saw ourselves as too fat, too skinny, too short, too awkward, not athletic enough, or tough or strong or good-looking enough. Whatever other qualities we admired in other males but judged to be lacking in ourselves. And most of us had grew up and we went to school and it hadn't been so long ago, we've forgotten. We remember that either you were one of those that was made fun of by the tough guys, or you were the tough guy who did it. We called them sissies and things of that nature. And that's what they're referring to. They felt deficient as males. And one of the things they talked about they did was, they began to look at those qualities in the male that they said, that's what a man is, and they saw those deficiencies in themselves. Then they began to idolize those qualities and really exalt them, which made the gulf between them and those qualities even greater, and they could never bridge them. So they actually, by idolizing them and really desiring them but putting them out here, they made themselves less seen in their own eyes as a man, or what they would say is called real men. They came to fear other boys. And these are, generally speaking, they are born and they do have a more sensitive aspect to them. They can have gentle personalities, not being, you know, bombastic or the football player, you know, that runs over everybody, you know, and he weighs 700 pounds in the first grade and things like that. And they felt different and they felt rejected by these rough, tough heroes, the ones that got all the notoriety and they were picked for this and they got the trophy and all of this. They looked at that and everybody said that's a man, and they didn't have those qualities. And there wasn't a man in their life, their dad, telling them what a real, authentic man is, see. He says, many of us feared the sports field. Many of us felt rejected by our fathers, and we feared that we could never measure up or would never really matter to them. So listen to what the summary of what they say. So where did this leave us as males ourselves? It left us in a neverland of gender confusion. Not fully masculine, but not really feminine either. We had disassociated not just from individual men we feared who would hurt us, but from the entire heterosexual male world. So again, I hope it tugs upon your heart to see that there are these environmental things, and the biblical family is the family. And it's not just harsh rulership and all of that, but it is a very involved and engaged family. And what they're telling us is that things that happened, the detached role with the dad, and then when you exacerbate this, that they're getting this from their peers as well, they don't have anybody affirming what an authentic man is. And so they walk out into the world, and they're not really a woman, they know that, but they're not a man, apparently. And so, they don't know really what they are. And that really breaks my heart. Third, is the mother-son relationship. And they call this the smothering mother syndrome. 9 out of 10 said that this was a contributing factor. 9 out of 10. Moms, listen. 9 out of 10. They said this, and this is so men's fraternity. Even as we perceived our fathers as abandoning, ignoring, or being hostile toward us, it was a common experience for us to over-identify with or become overly dependent on our mothers. We never fully cut the apron strings that attached our identity to her. Mom often became our confidant and mentor instead of dad. But mom could never show us how to act and think like a man. So it was common for us to view maleness from a woman's perspective instead of a man's. We inadvertently adopted a woman's view of the world. There's nothing wrong with a woman's view of the world, right? There is something wrong when a man has a woman's view of the world rather than a man's view. The gulf between us and the world of men was widened and reinforced. They go on to say, feeling alienated from the male world, we often found comfort in female companionship. Some of us labeled women and femininity as superior to men and masculinity because we perceived females as more sensitive, accepting, and loving, and they felt safer with them, see? It says, instead of ridiculing our sensitive natures, they appreciated it. So the mom plays a role. You see, the mom, it's always the case. I mean, there's so many things. I don't know if we should get little Johnny a toy gun. Maybe he's going to learn to hurt people. And maybe we could get him Jax or something. Or a doll. No, get him a gun and a helmet and a sword and let him go out and dig in the dirt. And, you know, the mom babysits the children, and when you get home, I mean, the worst thing they got on them is a little chocolate smudge, and they still look neat, and their jeans are all intact. Dad keeps them for 30 minutes, and my goodness, it looks like they've been run over by a tractor. And that's a good thing, moms. That's a great thing. That's what we bring to the table, is risk and hurt and pain and dirt. And it's so necessary. So let them be boys. Back off sometimes. There's a book, Christian Child Rearing and Personality Development, by Dr. Paul Meyer. He's a medical doctor. And one of the things I always liked about the book, it's been out for many years, but he approached child rearing from a different vantage point. We're trying to rear good children, but he approaches it from the vantage point. If you want to rear an alcoholic child, here's what you need to do. And he gives you 10 steps. If you want to rear a homosexual, here's what you need to do. And he shows you how to do it. And of course, hopefully we're wise enough to say, well, if that's the way you do it, I'm going to do the opposite. But it's very, very illuminating. Fourth, they mentioned sexual abuse 48%. 48% said they were sexually abused by a more powerful person while they were growing up, and they believe that that has contributed to their same-sex attraction. The fifth thing is just other sexual experiences. 93% said that, and it could be pornography or some kind of involvement or something, just a whole host of menagerie of different things that could have played a part, and they say they look back and find these contributing. The sixth thing that they give is personality traits, and that's 87% see that as a contributing factor. Notice they're not calling any of these causes, they're calling them contributing factors, but when they coalesce, you have a pretty powerful drive in a particular direction. And a lot of times, you know, they're the young boy who is more innately sensitive. Maybe he's not the football player, but he's an artist or musician or likes to read. He's academic. And all of those are absolutely phenomenal qualities. And if he grows up, he finds that out. But he needs somebody to walk him through those times. He said, They say that they found these loving and gentle and kind, and often they're more spiritually inclined. They found them as a blessing and a curse, because there was a blessing side. The curse was the rough and tumble males. That's what they taunted them for, those very things. The girls welcomed them into the inner circles. That was a curse. And the moms wanted to hold on them and protect them more. And the dads tended to distance themselves from that kind of person. So all of these things are coalescing. And listen to this. This is just kind of a summary that they give about all of these contributing factors. And the reason I think this is important, it is a choice, but make no mistake about it, it's not just this simple little easy choice. There are factors involved that it may have been going on for their whole life. It says, these and other hurts were oftentimes the problems buried below the surface, complex, interwoven, and painful. They drove us to homosexual relationships in an attempt to find healing. But we found that for us, acting on these homosexual desires actually worsened rather than lessened the underlying problems. Homosexuality for us wasn't the solution. It was an escape from solving the real problems that had caused the symptoms to begin with, kind of like drugs or alcohol or overspending, all of these other things. They don't go back and address the real issue. It goes on, time alone could never really heal these kinds of deep wounds. Without our going back to face them, acknowledge them, grieve them, release our legitimate anger over them, take steps to repair the damage they had caused to us, and finally to forgive and to move on. And so that's some of the contributing factors in this whole area of homosexuality. And if we're going to work with them, there has to be a sensitivity and a patience and so forth. And so next time we'll look at what are some of the things that they need from us if there's going to be real healing. So if you'll bow with me, we'll pray. Lord, thanks for your word, and we're just reminded that sometimes beneath anger, beneath certain behaviors, there are other issues. And while we don't blame them, we understand that they do contribute into making us what we are and bringing about certain proclivities in our life and predispositions. And Lord, I would just ask you that we would never really be afraid of sharing the truth, and that you would give us those kinds of opportunities. And that we would do it in a way that really is speaking the truth in love, and that we would know the truth, that we would be able to communicate that. And we would not look merely at a success rate to vindicate, but we would look at what you say in your word. And we do pray, we know that many of us here have family members or friends, some associate, and we sometimes are somewhat baffled in how to approach the situation. Maybe we've tried and hasn't worked. But Lord, that we would really be people who would take on not just the easy situations, the good neighbor, but we would take on the difficult ones as well.
You know, Galatians 6:1 advises us to reach out to someone who is overtaken in sin. No indifference there. But first we must consider our own sin. Only then are we prepared to reach out to someone struggling with homosexuality. If God gives you an opportunity to help someone like that, study so that you understand their struggles. Then be ready to offer kindness and patience and love. They may need all the support you can muster.